Cha-ching. That's the sound of Lowe's Labor Day savings. Get up to 45% off select major appliances and save up to an additional $100 on select laundry pairs. Plus, get 3 bags of Miracle-Gro 0.75 cubic foot garden soil for just $10. Labor Day deals are on now at Lowe's, in-store and online. Valid through 9/9 while supplies last. Selection varies by location. See Lowe's.com for more details. Soil offer excludes Alaska and Hawaii.
Tyler Reddick here from 2311 Racing. The rush of racing? Nothing beats it. But Chumba Casino comes close. Chumba's got fast spins, fun games, daily bonuses, and all the action you can handle. Now that's a ride. Ready to hit the throttle? Get in the driver's seat and head to ChumbaCasino.com. Let's Chumba.
Sponsored by Chumba Casino. No purchase necessary. VGW Group. Void where prohibited by law. 21 plus. Terms and conditions apply.
From NBI Studios, this is Truth and Justice, a crowdsourced investigation in real time. I'm Bob Ruff. Hello, everybody, and welcome back to Truth and Justice. For today's episode, this is going to be part 2 of 3 episodes where I'm breaking down the facts of the Delphi case and specifically the trial. I made the decision before I even started today that I don't want to try to jam all of what I have left into one episode. What I have today, primarily I'm going to be focusing on the firearms evidence, and that is Melissa Oberg's testimony. And then what I have up next is all of the stuff about Dr. Walla and Richard Allen's confessions. I decided that those two things, neither one of them are super long, but combined together, they're too long for one episode, and it's going to kind of muddy the waters. So what I'm going to do today is I'm going to cover the firearms testimony. I'm going to skip past the stuff about Dr. Walla and the confession. I'll cover all of that next week. And then there's a few things that I have that are kind of a hodgepodge, just things people say about this case, things I've heard, things I've even repeated because I've heard them so many times, that I want to be just real clear about what the record actually indicates. And those three elements are the voice comparison of the bridge guy video compared to Allen, what was actually said at trial and who said it, the height from the video where we've heard that there was a range of heights and how that compares to Richard Allen, what was actually said about that. And then also what was testified to in regards to what Libby says in the video, that we go down or that be a gun piece of it. So all those are kind of short, even the firearms evidence. I'm going to do my best with the firearms stuff not to overly complicate it. I tried to just make notes based on what I read in the trial transcript. I'll tell you just kind of, I guess, as a bit of a spoiler, just to give you a heads up of where we're going to end up here is I still feel the exact same way I've always felt about the firearms evidence. I mean, this is just, you'll see as we go through, Oberg's testimony is not clear cut enough at all for me to say, yep, that bullet came from Richard Allen's gun. And as I go through this, you'll see why. So without any further ado, this episode should be shorter than last week's, just because, you know, instead we're dealing with one witness instead of 4 witnesses, and there's just not a lot there, you know, to go over that's not just super duper technical stuff. And actually, her testimony really wasn't all that technical. As Zach mentioned in the follow-up last week, she didn't put up any pictures. She didn't show anything explaining, see this mark here, that's how I know it matches this. She's just talking about her analysis, how she came to her conclusions, and, you know, how it was verified by another examiner. So let's move into this. So the scope of this section is going to be Oberg's firearms / tool mark testimony about the cartridge recovered at the crime scene that was listed as laboratory item number 16 or State's Exhibit 148 if you're trying to track any of this through the trial transcript stuff. So let's move. I've got it broken down into several different categories. The first one is what the evidence item actually was. What was found at the crime scene was an unfired Winchester 40 caliber jacketed hollow point cartridge with a nickel case and a brass primer. Oberg observed at least three ejector marks, at least three extractor marks, and some additional marks on that cartridge. Now, I'll get into this a little bit more as we go through, but from my understanding of what she was testifying to, what she's testifying to is the fact that this cartridge had been ejected multiple times, perhaps three times from the gun. So it's not like all the marks weren't that, she's not saying that the gun created all three of those marks. Her analysis is that that bullet had been put into that gun and ejected out of it, and then put back in and ejected out of it, and then put back in and ejected out of it several times to create all of these marks. And that may, for people that are not familiar with firearms, that may sound a little odd. Like, why would somebody do that over and over again? There are lots of reasons. My assumption, the most typical reason is for that, is that that is the top round in the magazine. So people who carry firearms that maybe have a concealed weapons carry permit generally will carry your gun with a round loaded into the chamber. And so oftentimes your top round in the magazine gets, you know, cycled through the gun often because, you know, you'll put your magazine in, you'll rack the gun, loading one into the chamber, you'll carry it. And then if there comes a time later where you need to unload the gun, now a lot of people don't unload it every single time. If they keep it like in a locked safe or something like that, they may keep one chambered at all times. But there are circumstances that come up where you need to unload your gun. The way you do that is you drop the magazine out of the gun and you rack it, and that ejects the shell. And then you take that shell and you put it back into the magazine and have it sitting next to it. And then the next time you load your gun, obviously you put the magazine back in, rack it, and now it's reloaded again. So that's most likely the reason why there are multiple ejector marks on this gun. Now, something that's not said at trial, I'm kind of getting ahead of myself, but I'm just trying to give you guys some perspective on some of this stuff before I go through it, because it's not super duper interesting when we start going through what she actually testified to. But what I find interesting about it is that she says that this round that's found on the crime scene has three sets of ejector marks on it. Again, meaning it was cycled through the gun multiple times. Practically speaking, what that tells me is that that gun, whatever gun it came out of, makes that mark every time it ejects it, right? So it's not like this one strange time where the round was ejected out of the gun and it happened to make this mark. It was ejected at least three times and made those marks at least three times. And these, again, is it's accurate what we talked about before, that Richard Allen's gun was not capable of making those marks without firing the gun. So that's just something to ponder there. Well, I just went through this, but what I have in my notes is what the multiple marks meant. She did testify that the cartridge had likely been cycled at least three times, which is what I just said. So I already had that written in my notes. Now, another big question, and probably the big question here, is what other firearms were examined? There's two problems that I had with what I had heard about the examination. One was the fact that she had to fire the gun in order to make the marks, or at least make the marks clear enough to identify. That's a problem for me. And then the other problem is, what else are we comparing it to? Are you able to, is there some sort of unique thing on these marks that can exclude all other guns except Richard Allen's? Or is it just compared to just a handful of other guns and Richard Allen's was the only one that couldn't be excluded? Well, and as it turns out, the latter is true. So, and I don't know why, I don't remember if it said and I just didn't write it down, but I don't recall ever reading this. I don't know why she chose these guns, but she tested a Glock Model 22, which is also a 40 caliber. And in that one, she test cycled it, which is just cycling it is just racking the gun, racking the bullet out, creating an unspent round. She racked it, so tested a cycled round, and then also test fired it. And she noted that the ejector position and shape differed from the marks on the round from the crime scene. So because of that, she was able to exclude that bullet did not come from a Glock 22. So the Glock 20 Model 22 is excluded as a possibility. And again, I don't know why she chose. I mean, there's all kinds of lots and lots and lots. I don't know how many, but lots and lots of 40 caliber guns, makes and models. I don't know what made her decide to test just the Glock 22, but she did that. And then she also tested a Smith & Wesson M&P 40, also a 40 caliber. And again, test fired it and test cycled it. The ejector shape, ejector shear, and chamber marks all differed from the round found at the crime scene. So she was able to exclude a Smith & Wesson M&P 40. Now, my assumption is they're not clear, I think on purpose, at trial where these guns came from. My assumption is that they are guns from suspects. I believe that to be true. I don't think that she just randomly thought, let's try a Glock. I think that it's that Glock belonged to a suspect. So she tested that one. The M&P 40 belonged to a suspect or person of interest. And she tested that one. But in any case, she was able to exclude that round did not come from a Glock 22. And it did not come from a Smith & Wesson M&P 40. Now, she also, and the reason I said that I think those came from suspects is because she also tested a Sig Sauer P239. Now, we know that is Brad Weber's gun. That's the one we've talked about that said, well, Brad Weber's gun couldn't be excluded either. His was the Sig Sauer P239, 40 caliber. And it does say in the trial transcripts, I wasn't clear about this last time we talked about it, and I see in the transcript, she did test fire it and test cycle it. So that means she checked rounds that were just cycled through the gun, and she also checked round that was fired through the gun. Now that one, she said it shared class characteristics, but it's heavy ejector subclass. This is what, I mean, there's some pretty technical stuff here, but it's heavy ejector subclass marks don't appear on item 16. So she's saying that there was a mark made on the round from, I'll just call it for simplicity's sake, Brian Weber's gun that she didn't see on the round from the crime scene. And there was no substantial individual agreement, meaning when she looked at the two, there was nothing that said, yes, these two match. But at the same time, there was also nothing saying, well, this round could not have come from that gun. It's this weird area. So ultimately, she was neither able to identify Brad Weber's gun as being the source of the bullet, nor was she able to exclude it. The next she testified to, which I don't, it seems like maybe the purpose for even talking about this is to seem like she was doing due diligence, but there were four guns that were recovered like in the water when they were searched. I don't know. There was a few different times where they were you know, searching through the rivers and creeks and things. Some of that had to do with that Keegan Klein, where he had kind of sent them on what appears to be maybe a wild goose chase to look for a gun in the water. The thing was, none of those guns were even 40 caliber. So one was a Springfield Armory 45 caliber, and the other three also weren't 40 caliber. So she said none fit or could have cycled item 16. So again, to me, like, I don't know why we're even talking about guns that aren't 40 caliber, but she did talk about those four at trial. And I think, I don't know, when I was reading it, it feels like that was a good way to make it seem like she was testing all these guns. We also tested these four guns we found. Well, she didn't test them. She looked at them and they weren't 40 caliber. So she knew that the bullet didn't come from them. It couldn't have come from them. And that's it. That's all she tested. So she tested a Glock 22. That was excluded. She tested a Smith & Wesson M&P 40. That was excluded. She tested a Sig Sauer P239 and couldn't include or exclude that one. And then Richard Allen's gun. So in all reality, she only tested that round against four guns total, Richard Allen's and three others. I'm not including the other four that they found in the river because they weren't even 40 caliber.
Every runner knows the feeling when you finally hit your stride. You stop thinking about every step and start focusing on the journey ahead. Running a small business should feel a little more like that. But when you're juggling payroll, benefits, hiring, and HR compliance on top of everything else, it's hard to find your rhythm. That's where JustWorks comes in. JustWorks handles the back office admin small business owners can't afford to get wrong. Combining intuitive software with real human support, they help keep your business moving forward. Think of JustWorks as a running buddy for your business. The support system that's there to help lighten the load so you can focus on the road ahead. Building something great takes endurance, and the right support can make every step feel a little lighter. Chase your dream, not the paperwork, because you don't have to worry when it just works. Head to justworks.com to learn more.
Got stubborn spots, unwanted hair, or uneven skin? The CAPS Laser Center offers advanced solutions. They offer a full range of advanced laser treatments like Halo and Moxie that help reveal smoother, clearer, healthier-looking skin. CAPS is one of the top providers in the world for laser treatments, and their expert team delivers personalized care every step of the way. When you book your first laser center appointment, you'll get a $50 CAPS MedSpa gift card. So don't wait. Book today at experiencecaps.com. CAPS, where confidence begins.
Happy birthday, America. It's time to celebrate and play your favorite Las Vegas casino games by American-owned SpinQuest.com. What's better than fireworks and American pie? Hitting a blackjack in the palm of your hand, and you won't lose your fingers. Over 1,000 games, including slots and live dealers. And $30 coin packs are on sale for $10. SpinQuest.com. Buy American players for American players.
SpinQuest is a free-to-play social casino. Void where prohibited. Visit SpinQuest.com for more details.
Tyler Reddick here from 2311 Racing. Another checkered flag for the books. Time to celebrate with Chumba. Jump in at ChumbaCasino.com. Let's Chumba.
No purchase necessary. VGW Group. Void where prohibited by law. CTNCs. 21 plus. Sponsored by Chumba Casino.
All right, so now let's move into what she actually found when examining Richard Allen's Sig Sauer P226. She received his gun on October 14th, 2022. So that's about the time they were arresting Richard Allen. That's when, you know, they performed the search warrant and got the gun. It had one Winchester cartridge in it, one Blazer cartridge, and then two magazines containing Blazer ammunition. To my knowledge, any of the Blazer stuff that I have, it's just like target shooting rounds. They're not like hollow point, something you would carry for personal protection. So she did 10 laboratory rounds that were tested in the lab, 10 test rounds with his gun. 4 were fired and 6 were just manually cycled, which again is what was done with the round that was found at the crime scene. It was just cycled. It wasn't fired. So she cycled 6, fired 4. In her opinion, she testified that the bullet from the crime scene had been cycled through Allen's P226 based on what she considered sufficient agreement in, and someone, I think Joshua in the follow-up was asking some specific questions. Here they are. She says that there was sufficient agreement in the ejector, extractor, and head/chamber or barrel hood marks. The barrel hood marks is an interesting one. I never heard of that. And actually, I'll get into it here, but that was talked about a little bit at trial. There's not a lot of empirical data about that. Her opinion was then verified by her supervisor, Mark Kiesler. He independently compared the specimens and verified the identification conclusion. So we do have two people, both Melissa Oberg and Mark Kiesler, looked at the marks and said, yes, we can include, for identification purposes, Richard Allen's gun. One thing she did not do is, she was asked on the stand, she could not express the conclusion as a statistical probability percentage or identification to the exclusion of all others. And this is, again, why I had said previously I had an issue with this. I still have an issue with it. She tested the round against 4 guns and said, well, it matches, you know, there are marks that have sufficient agreement with this one. So I'm saying it came from this one, but that's based out of a pool of only 4 guns, 2 of which were immediately excluded and 1 couldn't be included or excluded. And so, you know, what they were looking for in cross-examination was, you know, what we see in like DNA evidence. Like, you know, statistically, I can say that only 1 in 3 trillion people will have this exact DNA sequence. We don't have any of that. You know, there was no statistical probability. She was asked, can you identify this is the gun that fired it to the exclusion of all others? No, she couldn't say that either. Some of the limits and exposed weaknesses that came out during cross-examination, one was the big one that everyone's talked about, the fired versus unfired comparison. Although the crime scene cartridge was unfired and she produced 6 manually cycled rounds, Oberg used the 4 fired cartridge cases to make her identification. She said, because firing produced stronger marks. And she agreed that firing does create much more pressure and that the differences could result from comparing a fired case to a cycled cartridge. Essentially, she said in the transcript that that's how she did it. And then when she said, well, it doesn't firing it create more pressure, more heat, deeper marks, all that? And she said, yeah. And she agreed that could be why the differences are there, because one's fired and one's not fired. The 6 rounds that she just cycled, which again is what was done to the round on the crime scene, The 6 manually cycled rounds supplied limited extractor marks and little or no useful ejector marks. I realize I'm doing this and I'm doing exactly what I said I wouldn't do, which is give you analysis. So I guess you do with that what you want. But what we do know now is a fact. The round from the crime scene was just manually cycled through the gun. And doing so, whatever gun did that, created ejector marks. The 6 rounds that she manually cycled through Richard Allen's gun left limited extractor marks and little or no useful, those are her words, little or no useful ejector markings. She did not document round by round, saying like which marks appeared on which try. She just said that those 6 rounds did not help her make the identification. So she found manually cycled round on the crime scene. She manually cycled 6 rounds to Richard Allen's gun and could not reproduce the marks that were present on the crime scene round by doing that. She also, one of the things that was pointed out during cross-examination, and this is kind of getting into the weeds a little bit, but she did not do a pretest microscopic baseline. I mean, she didn't look at the rounds under a microscope before she ejected them to see what marks may have already been on them. She visually inspected the stock test ammunition, but did not microscopically inspect or photograph each cartridge before firing or cycling it. And that was something that was, obviously the jury didn't seem to care about it, but that was something that was pointed out in cross-examination. She never documented what the round looked like before she cycled it. Another thing that was pointed out during cross-examination, which I've mentioned many times, is that the comparison inventory, meaning all the guns she compared, they did include that P-239, Brian Weber's gun, but nowhere in her documentation or testified to did she test another P-226, which was Richard Allen's gun. She was never asked in the transcripts the precise yes or no question, did you test another P-226? The point is that no second P-226 appears in her listed tests. So, you know, I wish that the attorneys in cross-examination had asked that question. I think they should have. I think it would have been maybe it might have been an impactful question for the jury to hear. They never asked it. So what we have is she said, these are all the guns I tested. None of them were a second P-226. No one ever said, did you test another one? But there's no evidence that she did. Another thing that was interesting in reading the transcript is that she didn't compare. I'll just read it how I wrote it in my notes because I was reading it while I wrote these notes. So the Winchester and Blazer cartridges that were recovered with Allen's gun were not identified to that firearm, and they did not supply any additional association to the round found at the crime scene. Meaning she didn't look at the rounds that were with Richard Allen's gun and find markings on them that matched the markings at the crime scene either. And she also didn't compare any of the magazine ammunition to the crime scene ammo either. Now, one thing that she points out, which I don't think helps the case at all, but she said she didn't know how much that Richard Allen's gun was fired, cleaned, disassembled, repaired, or anything else between 2017 and its 2022 seizure. She testified that an identification remained possible if enough representative marks survived during that time period. So essentially what she's saying is that, you know, the gun could have been modified in any number of ways that would have changed the way it makes marks over those 5 years. And she's kind of using it as, so maybe it used to 5 years ago, maybe it did make the marks when it manually cycled it, and it just doesn't now. She just left it open, right? So it could be also maybe the marks that it makes when firing now would have been different. It wouldn't have been present back then. Anyway, that just, again, like I said, when you go through her testimony, there's nothing in there that I read that was like, oh, now that I see it in black and white, I see exactly how she made the comparison and I'm confident in the match. I don't think that anybody reading it would come to that conclusion. Continuing on with issues pointed out during cross-examination, there were some subclass characteristic issues. Oberg agrees that Allen's ejector showed subclass characteristics, and that the extractor's impression mark could contain subclass features. These are all like a lot of technical terms. It gets really long in the transcript. She said that the ejector mark alone, or the ejector in his gun, was insufficient to make a match. She did not physically inspect the manufacturing tool that made the extractor, and she identified no peer-reviewed study specific to the P226 chamber face marks. It also pointed out there was no breech face evidence because the crime scene round was unfired. It had no usable breech face impression. That common fired case comparison area was unavailable to her. And that's why this is all very unique, because we're testing unspent rounds. Most of the time when you hear firearms and tool mark analysis is based on a spent round. But this one was unspent, so we didn't have that, you know, like the breech face evidence. And also, as I mentioned earlier, she described that research on chamber marks, the word she used was lean, and research on unfired cycling examination is even leaner than that. So in her own words at trial, like the way that she made this match, there's not like a big data set and all kinds of empirical research on how to do it. Like I said, she said it's very lean, the amount of evidence. It's just not something that's generally done, if you want to sum it up into kind of layman's terms. Moving on, she testified that she agreed that the discipline is subjective and different examiners can perceive different features. The verifier, her supervisor that verified her findings, spent at most a couple hours on the comparison and did not redo the entire examination from the beginning. So that's something that I think should be pointed out, because I've heard it said that it was examined by her and her supervisor and they both agreed it was a match. It's not an accurate way to say it. She went through all of the testing, did all of the examination, and then he reviewed her work. He didn't then go through and examine it himself and come to his own conclusion. And moving on, as Zach mentioned, that there was no photos presented at trial. She testified that the photographs just didn't capture everything she saw through the microscope and were, her words were, representative memorializations. They were not the basis of her conclusion. So, I don't know. Essentially, she's saying the pictures don't show why it's a match. I could see it through the microscope. You can't really see it in the pictures. So kind of like how Zach put it last week was, so just trust me, it matches. And then one other thing that was brought up, it was interesting that it, you know, I didn't even think about till it came up at trial, but it said the original 2017 submission of the firearm bullet that was sent to the lab included a sentence that two girls were murdered. That's not generally how it's done. Usually the lab examiners are supposed to be completely impartial and not know any details of the case. And she said that the lab has since changed their practice and removed that type of case context to reduce possible influence. So since then, they've changed that rule because of this. But, you know, I didn't see anything indicating that she was necessarily influenced by that. But who knows? She did know that it came from two girls being murdered, for what it's worth. As far as error rate in the juror questioning, you know, where the jurors are able to ask the judge to ask her questions, she discussed black box study rates of about 2.2% of false positives and 2.87% false negatives, noting that inconclusive results and different reporting scales affect calculation rates. So, I mean, that's just, those are just numbers. If you're a numbers person, that there is some empirical studies of firearms examination that shows that there are these error rates of between 2 and 3%. And then lastly, and again, this is just the last thing that kind of came up in cross-examination regarding the force of cycling, you know, like how hard you rack the round. She said that she couldn't ensure that every manual cycle used the exact same amount of force. She agrees that force can affect the depth and consistency of the resulting marks. I mean, essentially, the whole thing just comes down to, this is a very, very gray area. I don't know any other way to read it. You can read the transcript for yourself. This is what was said. But there was just all kinds of testimony about why this wasn't an exact science, for lack of a better term. So I have a little section of my notes here that says the bottom line of this section, she gave an identification opinion tying the unspent cartridge to the cycling through Allen's gun, but she did not come to that conclusion by cycling it. She came to it by firing it. She did not express it in any numerical probability or to the exclusion of every other firearm. As I mentioned, the Brian Weber gun remained inconclusive. She said it didn't come from the Glock or the M&P40. Those were described as excludable. And of course, the four guns found in the water weren't even the right caliber. and the trial record shows no comparison against any other P226. So that's it. That's all the firearms examination evidence. I didn't find, for me, any surprises there. It was pretty much what I had been told, you know, with a little bit of more detail. But essentially, she tested that unspent round against four guns of that caliber. Two could be excluded. One was inconclusive. And Richard Allen's could be included with a fired round, not with an unfired round.
Every runner knows the feeling when you finally hit your stride. You stop thinking about every step and start focusing on the journey ahead. Running a small business should feel a little more like that. But when you're juggling payroll, benefits, hiring, and HR compliance on top of everything else, it's hard to find your rhythm. That's where JustWorks comes in. JustWorks handles the back office admin small business owners can't afford to get wrong. Combining intuitive software with real human support, they help keep your business moving forward. Think of JustWorks as a running buddy for your business. The support system that's there to help lighten the load so you can focus on the road ahead. Building something great takes endurance, and the right support can make every step feel a little lighter. Chase your dream, not the paperwork, because you don't have to worry when it just works. Head to justworks.com to learn more.
Ever thought about Botox but worry you'll look, well, overdone? You're not alone. That's exactly why so many people choose Caps. Their approach is all about keeping your expression natural because Botox shouldn't freeze your face. It should refresh it. At Caps, treatments are performed by licensed nurses known for precise and subtle refined enhancements, all overseen by nationally ranked plastic surgeons. Now's the perfect time to start Botox. Book your first appointment and receive a $50 Caps MedSpa gift card. Schedule today at experiencecaps.com. Caps, where confidence begins.
Hey everybody, Lady Luck here, and we're celebrating America's 250th birthday. Now all summer long, I'm going to be celebrating by playing on SpinQuest.com, which is an American-owned social casino. It obviously features over 1,000 slot games and live blackjack, live craps, live bubble craps. Head on over to SpinQuest.com, get yourself a $30 coin pack for just 10 bucks.
SpinQuest is a free-to-play social casino. Void where prohibited. Visit SpinQuest.com for more details.
Tyler Reddick here from 2311 Racing. Victory lane? Yeah, it's even better with Chumba by my side. Race to ChumbaCasino.com. Let's Chumba.
No purchase necessary. VGW Group. Void where prohibited by law. CTNCs. 21 plus. Sponsored by Chumba Casino.
All right, for our closing segment today, I'm just going to go over kind of the fact versus fiction, you know, what people are saying, how they're conflating things about three different areas. One, and I'm bringing this up because it was something that Anya pointed out during our discussion, was the voice comparison of the guys down the hill from the video to Richard Allen, what was actually said about that at trial and who said it. The height from the video, one of the things that the innocent camp says a lot is that there was a height range released by law enforcement and Richard Allen was not included in that. I'll talk about where that came from and how accurate it could be. Then lastly, we're going to talk about the voice, what Libby said in the video, what was actually said at trial about that, whether she said that we go down or that be a gun. And that's it. And I think that then will wrap up most of the points of contention about the case and leave us with all the Dr. Wallace stuff and the confessions for next week. So let's circle back. Let's go first to the voice comparison. This is, you know, Anya said that when she heard Richard Allen talking, she was like, yep, that's the guy from the video. I've heard people say that, you know, that law enforcement, that some analysis was done and it was determined that it was his voice. Here's the reality. There was no official expert analysis done that tied Richard Allen's voice or identified the voice in the video as Richard Allen's. That just didn't happen. This is what actually happened. This is what was it came out at trial. So Master Trooper Brian Harshman, after reviewing the video and listening to more than 700 of Richard Allen's phone calls, he testified that the voice is Richard Allen's. Now, it all depends how you look at that, how strong that is. He is not an expert. He has no formal training in doing this. He is just a guy who listened to a bunch of phone calls and listened to the audio on the tape or on the video and said that was him. His testimony did not describe a forensic phonetic analysis, no voice print testing, or a retained voice identification expert. So this is, I think it's telling that the state did not put on an expert that identified that voice as coming from Richard Allen. And again, this is one of those things you can put whatever weight into it you want, but I'll say this, if there was an expert that could listen to that and through a scientific method determine it was his voice, we would have heard from them. It doesn't exist. Now, Harshman was not the only person to testify about the voice. We also have Stephen Mullen. He testified that over the years, more than dozens and perhaps even hundreds, he said, of people have reported believing the voice belonged to someone that they knew. So he's talking about all the tips that had come in. Dozens up to hundreds of people have all said that they heard the voice and they know it's XYZ person. And again, so he's describing tips, not validated identifications. But the point is, while Harshman said, oh, I heard the voice and then I heard this guy talking and I'm certain it's him, you know, dozens to hundreds of people have said the exact same thing about other people. That did come out at trial. Now, we also had Lieutenant Jerry Holman. He told Allen, I think this is where some of the confusion comes in. So anybody that's watched the videos of Richard Allen's interrogations, during the October 22 interrogation, Holman told Allen in that recording that experts had said the man in the video and the voice were Allen. He told him that was part of the indisputable evidence, part of the Reed technique we talked about a couple of weeks ago. So one of the things he told him was there was irrefutable evidence that an expert had identified the voice as coming from Richard Allen. At trial, Holman on the stand had to admit that no expert had said that and that the claim was an interrogation lie. So that's what we have as far as the voice. There's no expert that has ever said that that was Richard Allen's voice. The one indication that an expert had was a lie that Holman told Allen during the interrogation. On the flip side of that, I didn't see anywhere in the trial where any law enforcement officers testified that it was not Richard Allen's voice. So my takeaway from that is exactly where it was before I went into this. When I really looked at all the evidence that's out there, my opinion was, well, unless an expert can tell me scientifically that was his voice, anybody's opinion is just their opinion. After reading through all the trial testimony about it, I'm still of the same opinion on that. Next, let's move into the height. One thing that I have heard over and over and over and over again was that the FBI or law enforcement gave a height range of 5'6" to 5'10", and Richard Allen is 5'4". And that has been conflated to say that that was based on photogrammetry evidence from the video, from Libby's video. You know, and again, that's something that I've repeated because I've heard it over and over again. I went through the trial transcripts trying to find that testimony, and what I found was, unless I missed it somewhere, it doesn't exist. Nowhere at trial did anybody testify to the range of height of the killer. So what we do know from trial, Holman testified that investigators tried or that they considered obtaining a height analysis, but they did not ever have one performed. He said that the estimated cost was about $10,000 to have it done, but then he said that money wasn't the issue. He expected that accuracy or the fear that it wouldn't be accurate was the concern. He thought the proposed range may have been plus or minus 2 inches, but did not recall exactly. So that's the closest we get to where that number came from. I found just on a personal level, you have this horrific murder of two young girls that remained unsolved for so many years. And they looked into the fact that for $10,000, they could have had an analysis done on the height of the person and chose not to do it, which again, he points out that it would have been 10 grand, but then he also said that's not the reason they didn't do it. As it stands, the trial record does not contain any complete video derived height estimate for Bridge Guy. The Bridge Guy height is not trial evidence. It didn't come in anywhere in the trial. The only discussion about it was what I just said, which was where Holman testified that they just never did an analysis. So where does the range come from? Best I can tell, The range comes from July of 2017, you know, so about 5 months after the murders, when the first sketch was released. In that release, the Indiana State Police said that the person in the photo, the person they're looking for, is a white male between 5'6" and 5'10". A year later, the FBI posted on their wanted list this case, and they repeated the same thing in there, that the height of the person they're looking for is from 5'6" to 5'10". Same thing as the Indiana State Police put in there. That's where the range comes from. What we don't know is how they came to that conclusion. Holman says they never did a height analysis. So I don't know where they came to that conclusion. If I had to guess, I would say it's from the witness statements. If you go through in last week's episode, how tall everybody said that, you know, all the different witnesses said that the man they saw was, you know, we had Wilburn Voorhees, who I think it was Voorhees who said that she was 5'7" and the man was taller than her. And then I think it was Wilbur who said that, you know, she came up to his upper forearm or something like that. So like they were, the witnesses at the scene were giving descriptions of the height. So I don't know if that's where it came from, but it's really neither here nor there. I think the important part, if our goal here is to make sure all the facts are out there, when people are repeating, there was an analysis done and Bridge Guy is between 5'6" and 5'10", and they're using that as evidence of Richard Allen's innocence because he's under that range. In reality, unless there's information that I'm unaware of, it certainly didn't come out of trial, we have no idea where that range came from. And it seems like because it came out with the sketch, that the most likely source of that was eyewitness testimony, not an analysis, like a photogrammetry analysis. So just so we're clear, that range, 5'6" to 5'10", is out there, but it does not appear, at least it's never been cited, where that analysis came from, or if it came from any analysis at all, or just eyewitness testimony. Okay, moving on to our last little piece here. And this is, what do we hear in Libby's video? So we have Sheriff Tony Liggett's interpretation. He said, after viewing the video hundreds of times, Liggett said headphones were the best way to listen. He testified that he heard Abby ask whether the man was right there and tell Libby not to leave her. He says that he heard Libby discuss the path and whisper, "That be a gun," then heard a male say, "Guys," a girl responds, "Hi," and the male says, "Down the hill." So that's where we first hear in the trial testimony, "That be a gun." It's not from some expert or anything. That is from Sheriff Liggett saying he was listening with headphones and he heard "that be a gun." That's where it is. Again, just like the other piece, and with much of this trial, you know, we don't have some expert analysis about how they determine that. It's just this guy, this law enforcement officer, saying that when he listens, he listened to it many, 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 many times, and he heard "that be a gun." It's up to you. Listen to it. There's the audio's out there. You can listen to it on your own. The other thing was the gun racking statement. This was interesting. It was stricken from the trial record. I don't know if, you know, the jurors actually disregarded it, but in that testimony, Liggett next said that he then heard, after he heard "Guys down the hill" or somewhere in there, that he heard a gun rack. As soon as he said it, the defense objected. The judge sustained the objection and expressly struck the statement from the record. It is not admitted testimony that the gun racking sound is present. So that's another one of those things. Anyone who's saying there's definitely a gun racking, all I'm saying with all this, with both of these things, is that none of that is proven testimony. Whether she said "that be a gun," or she said "that we go down," or whether there was a gun racking as opposed to a twig snapping or nothing at all, none of that is actual evidence that was tested by any sort of expert. And as far as the gun racking, that wasn't even allowed. The judge didn't even allow that testimony to be in front of the jurors. He struck it from the record. She struck it from the record. Even the suggestion that there was a gun racking sound. which I assume is based on the objection, was because there's no evidence that that's true. That's just some person's opinion of what they heard. Now, there was some professional expert audio work done on that video. Jerry Chapman is the Indiana State Police examiner, and he was able to stabilize and enhance the recording, concentrating on the male voice at the end, and he testified that he believed the male said, "down the hill." Notably, he did not provide any testimony identifying a gun racking sound or corroborating that be a gun. So that's just, again, it doesn't mean that's not, everybody hears something differently, but I think it's worth noting that the one expert that did actually do audio work on that video, the only thing that he could positively testify to is that the male voice at the end says, "down the hill." And to me, that, again, there's not a surprise there. It's exactly what I've been saying. Anyone who says they are certain of what they're hearing, they may be certain, but that does not make it true. We have, because you can't know, you just can't know. And I think that's a great example of it, that Chapman, who actually did the work on it as an expert, as an examiner, he didn't even venture into either one of those areas. The only thing he could say that he's sure about is that the voice says down the hill. So what I have listed here is the exact evidentiary status. That be a gun was Liggett's admittedly lay interpretation of the audio. The gun racking interpretation was offered by him and then struck out. And Chapman's admitted technical testimony supported the down the hill phrase, but not the gun related interpretations, either the racking or that be a gun. So with that being said, I think that pretty much covers everything that was covered by Kevin and Anya in their episodes, other than Dr. Walla and the confession information. We're going to cover all that next week. I just want to dedicate a whole episode to that so we can get exactly the facts, exactly what was said and how it was said. As far as the stuff from this week, the big takeaways that I took from my research for this episode, the biggest one, again, the firearms examination, I was uncomfortable with it before. I'm just as uncomfortable with it now. But the big takeaway that I got was in the fact that, you know, I've been told over and over again that the bridge guy was 5'6" to 5'10". And my research into that, finding out that that was just a height that was given with the sketch and we have no kind of photogrammetry evidence to support it, makes me feel a lot less confident about that actual range. So that was, that part was significant to me. Everything else, for me at least, was pretty much exactly what I went into this research already kind of thinking. Let me know what you think and get your questions in for this week's follow-up. We'll be recording the follow-up this week tomorrow, Monday. So when you're listening to this, if you have a question or a comment you want to get in, jump over to Facebook or Patreon or DM me anywhere what your questions are right away so we can get them in on Monday. And we'll talk about all this on the follow-up. Thanks, everybody. Truth and Justice is an NBI Studios production, co-written and produced by Erica Bergenham. Music created and composed by Caden Ladislaw. Follow-up episodes are co-hosted by Janet Varney and Zach Weber. Our logo font was created by Tate Krupa of Red Swan Graphic Design. Our website is created, managed, and maintained by Katie Ross of createdintandem.com. Thank you to our volunteer transcription team, Erica Cantor, Kathy McElhaney, Courtney Wimberly, Kaywood Yomnick, Danielle Rohr, Jennifer Athey, and Caroline Dwyer. Truth and Justice provides all investigative and advocacy work for the wrongfully convicted completely free of charge. We're able to do that in large part thanks to you, our listeners, through your generous pledges on Patreon. Patreon accounts for the overwhelming majority of our funding. The number one way you can support our work is to become a patron at patreon.com/truthandjustice. For just $5 a month, you'll get all episodes ad-free, a bonus pregame episode every Wednesday, and also a video version of the Friday follow-ups exclusive to our patrons. Patrons also get to participate and join the chat live in many of our interviews and get early access to much of our content. Just go to patreon.com/truthandjustice to sign up. You can also help us out by going to iTunes and leaving us a 5-star rating and review. It doesn't cost you a penny and goes a long way towards making the show more visible. If you have a new case that you'd like us to consider, you can submit your cases on our website, truthandjusticepod.com. Just click on the case submission button and fill out the form. You can always keep in touch with us through our email at theories@truthandjusticepod.com. You can like our Facebook page or join in on the conversation on the official Truth and Justice Podcast fans page. You can also connect with us on social media platform X at Truth Justice Pod. And to follow our personal accounts on social media, I can be found at Bob Ruff Truth. Janet can be found at Janet Varney. And Zach is at Z to the Q. However you do it, stay engaged and stay in touch. But as for now, we're signing off. I'm Bob Ruff.
I'm Zach Weaver.
And I'm Janet Varney.
And this has been Truth and Justice.
Ever thought about Botox but worry you'll look, well, overdone? You're not alone. That's exactly why so many people choose Caps. Their approach is all about keeping your expression natural because Botox shouldn't freeze your face. It should refresh it. At Caps, treatments are performed by licensed nurses known for precise and subtle refined enhancements, all overseen by nationally ranked plastic surgeons. Now's the perfect time to start Botox. Book your first appointment and receive a $50 Caps MedSpa gift card. Schedule today at experiencecaps.com. Caps, where confidence begins.
Tyler Reddick here from 2311 Racing. Victory lane? Yeah, it's even better with Chumba by my side. Race to ChumbaCasino.com. Let's Chumba.
No purchase necessary. VGW Group. Void where prohibited by law. CTNCs 21 plus. Sponsored by Chumba Casino.
Andy and Anna here from your new favorite podcast, No Such Thing as a Fish.
Yes, we are two of the four hosts of the podcast that stuffs fascinating, amazing, weird, mad facts into your ears on a weekly basis. You got any good facts, Andy?
Yes, how about this one? Anteaters have evolved on 12 separate occasions.
Wow.
Mysterious. Wonderful.
The world really wants them to exist. What about this one? When Ronald Reagan left office, he left a note on the White House lawn for the squirrels, warning them to beware of George Bush's dogs.
So there you go. If you like fascinating facts and much more besides, we are No Such Thing as a Fish.